Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Welcome to the Emerald Publishing Podcast Series. My name is Daniel Ridge, and I'm a commissioning editor at Emerald Publishing. In today's episode, I'm joined by author and editor Aaron Pritchard to discuss representations of dwarfism and counteracting ableist attitudes both in popular media and in everyday life. Aaron is a senior lecturer in disability studies and a core member of the Center for Culture and Disability Studies at Liverpool Hope University. She also serves as a consultant to Walt Disney Productions on representations of dwarfism. Aaron is the author of the recent publication, Dwarfism, Arts, and Advocacy, Creating Our Own Positive Identity. Her book addresses the glaring lack of representation of dwarfism in disability arts. It brings together leading activists, academics, and art practitioners with lived experiences of dwarfism to raise awareness and challenge ableist representations within academia and society. By raising a collective voice, the authors offer their thoughts, experiences, and recommendations for improving representations of dwarfism and counteracting ableist attitudes in both media and everyday life. As editor of this collection, Aaron has joined us to discuss some of the main themes and issues that run through the various chapters, and offer her perspective on the representation of dwarfism in popular culture and how activists are challenging harmful popular representations.
I'm a core member of the Centre for Culture and Disability Studies at Liverpool Hope. So my research is mostly on cultural representations of dwarfism. But I've also been a trustee for a few disability arts organisations and worked with them, such as Dada Fest and Disability Arts Online. But what I noticed in general, in these associations, but also reading about disability arts, is the lack of inclusion of people with dwarfism. And secondly, when it comes to dwarfism, there is a massive cultural presence within TV or film or anything like that. Yet, as a disability, and it's very much ignored. And there's a lot of advocacy going on, but we're not very aware of it. So people are still holding on to old stereotypes like the Seven Dwarfs. It's a great job for them. But actually, what people don't recognize is that a lot of people with dwarfism are pushing for more positive representations, but they're all kind of fractured. So you hear, everybody's heard of Peter Dinklage, but other actors and other activists, people haven't really heard about so much. And associations for people with dwarfism aren't that proactive, so in promoting positive representation. So I thought if I get this collective together, most of whom I knew via social media, but a couple I knew in person, like Tam Reynolds. Steph Robson I've never met, but I know her very well through social media. I thought, let's get their voices together and put something together, and so that this is collective voice, a strong voice.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of themes that run throughout the different chapters. And, a lot of this comes back to authentic representations of dwarfism. And you talked about midgetism or midget entertainment, which I think is something that, unfortunately, people may be more aware of and what comes to mind when they think of dwarfism. Can you talk a little bit about, authentic representation and what that might look like for different people in different fields?
For people with dwarfism, this authentic representation is just an everyday representation of dwarfism, a positive representation. So it's, we are real people. And I think that's what people seem to forget. We are disabled people, whereas people seem to think we're novelties, this separate race of people, a rarity. And so when you're in society, people see a real-life dwarf, and I've actually had that commented. So I wanted to create, what Danny Woodburn says, just an everyday representation. So he talks about in his chapter about playing a judge on some American program. He played a landlord on an episode of Murder, She Wrote, which was fantastic. And those are the kind of roles that we just want to play now. Because they're everyday roles and they normalize people with dwarfism. They show that we can be teachers or lawyers or doctors or whatever, and that we're not these mythical creatures that live in the woods, and we're not just, like Alice Lambert says, just not this novelty that comes on stage and sneezes a couple of times. it's an everyday representation that doesn't necessarily focus on our dwarfism. Our dwarfism is just there as part of our identity, but it's not the figure of entertainment in these authentic representations.
Well, that's what struck me in a couple of the chapters where you have actors talking about acting and just being viewed as comedic when their role isn't comedic. Them just being on stage is somehow comedic, to have a dwarf on stage. So I guess I'm a little struggling a little bit what I'm asking for, because I see such contradictions also within the dwarf community, because there are people that are willing to take those roles, and then there are people that are fighting against those roles. Can you talk to me a little bit about this tension?
Yeah, so what people seem to think, general society, is that everyone with dwarfism works in some form of entertainment, because that's the only place they've seen us. And this tends to be very derogatory, with the exception of, you know, some of the roles the people in the book talk about, or, you know, people like Peter Dinklage. So they all seem to think, because we're small, we can't do much, we can't do an everyday job. So you have this, but a minority, and that's what people need to remember. It's like a very small minority of people with dwarfism that still do derogatory roles that I refer to as midget entertainment, such as midget wrestling or pantomimes, you know, where their dwarfism is the only reason for them to be there and no actual talent. So that is a very few, because a lot have been turning their backs on it. And that's kind of why I wanted to do the book, to showcase that. So, you know, like Betty Adelson pointed out a few years ago, I think it was back in 2005, that even then people with dwarfism were refusing roles like such as the Seven Dwarfs in the pantomime, and sort of saying, no, I'm not doing that. I'm an actor. I'm not going to degrade them. Because they were seeing about how these social repercussions from these representations. And so if you don't want them, you don't do the representation.
Mm-hmm. Well, something I noticed as a theme throughout several of the chapters is the idea of dwarf pride. So could you elaborate on what dwarf pride might mean and how it challenges the pervasive negative perceptions of dwarfism in society?
Yeah, I think it was brought by a couple of people such as Nick Nowicki and Steph Robson. And for me, like, what I was getting from this dwarf pride is it's roles where we are not reducing ourselves to our dwarfism, and certainly not making dwarfism to be something that's inferior, so you're not laughing at dwarfism. You know, it's not saying that comedy's off limits, but you're not just using dwarfism as this novelty to be laughed at. Instead, you can be playing a complex role, or you could be doing a podcast that like Gillian does, like that highlights these very important issues in the dwarfism community and pushes for change. And that is dwarf pride. It's about pushing for your rights instead of just, you know, lying on your back and sort of just taking all the abuse and taking all these derogatory representations. It's about saying, you know, because a lot of people with dwarfism grow up and they can't look at someone else with dwarfism, because, I mean, I turn on the telly and I see some dancing dwarf elf and that's all they're doing is just making a fool of themselves. It doesn't fill you with pride. Whereas turning on the TV and seeing someone like Peter Dinklage or Danny Woodburn or Meredith Eaton, that fills you with pride because you see them as actors, real talented actors.
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw this too in some of the chapters that are about art and art installation. And it made me think about, you know, accessibility and how the world is designed for tall statured people who, when they go into an art exhibition, the art is at eye level. And you had some of your authors writing about challenging these norms. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there's a few good ones in that. There's Deborah Keenahan's sculpture. There's Amanda Katchia's work as a curator, which is great, you know, making big differences in museums. But also Steph Robson's photography exhibition, which was You're Just Little, because that was something that was said to her, and it's something that's said to a lot of people with dwarfism. They're saying, you're not disabled, you're just little. And yet, that's very disabling, as you're saying, this one-size-fits-all society. So she did this photography exhibition where she got loads of people with dwarfism to send in photos of just everyday things that are out of our height. So I sent some to her. I took them when I was in work, like of a lectern, a university lectern table being, you know, too high for me to see over. So you see this thing towering over you because it's from my perception. you see the coffee urns that people put out really too high up to reach. So you can't even do something as make a cup of coffee. You can't hang your coat up. You know, all these things, basic things, are out of reach for you. And so she put these all at our height. So I'm 4 foot. She put mine at 4 foot. Maybe someone's 3 foot 6. She put them up that height. And it got the participants to look at these photos by like kneeling down almost on their haunches, looking at these pictures. And that's when it hits them. Oh, right. Yeah. It's not just about high supermarket shelves. So I think that was very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That really struck me. Well, several of your contributors in the book discuss the idea of challenging the meta-narrative around dwarfism. So how do you think the mainstream entertainment industry has been complicit in perpetuating harmful stereotypes? And what are the consequences of that for people with dwarfism?
They've been very complicit, and it's never really been challenged. So the main sort of stereotypes associated with dwarfism is that you're either this mythical character, like the fantasy land, like Tolkien or Snow White or something, or you are, which is the predominant one, you're always funny, you're always humorous, you're always something to be laughed at, the butt of the joke, and more of a commodity than anything. Like, you know, people can pick you up, as in examples of dwarf tossing or midget tossing or anything like that. And so people always see you as this plaything, and it's perpetuated in many films where, and by in many TV shows, where you think this kind of joke towards another minority group would be off limits, but with dwarfism, it's fine because they haven't challenged that. So that's something that we see time after time. And I was showing, I was doing a lecture for my students the other week, and it was about the Ovitz family, which was a group of people with dwarfism who were medically experimented on in Auschwitz during the Holocaust. So a lot of people, dwarfism, if they were captured by the Nazis, they would have just been killed, and their bones would have been, you know, displayed because they're so small. But these ones, because they were the family, they were just had went for these horrific medical experiments. And you look at the YouTube comments to the video that, you know, this part of this documentary that I showed, and they're just saying, haha, midgets are fun. Oh, that's so funny. And it's like, this is the Holocaust. This is painful medical experiments. And you're saying it's hilarious because it's a dwarf going through it. So it's got to be hilarious. Anything with dwarfism is automatically hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you fight against that?
You can do it in two ways. One, give people with dwarfism more roles in everyday, just, you know, everyday roles, like I said, like if it's a doctor's receptionist, if it's a judge, if it's anything, you know, the jobs that we do, like teaching or whatever. So that it normalizes and shows it's not these funny novelties, but actual people, you know, fully fleshed people. And also, but if you're, you know, you don't need to avoid comedy, but have it that, like Simon Mintig is, we're not the butt of the joke, but you reverse the comedy role. So, and I think Tam Reynolds speaks about this as well. You're not laughing at them. You're laughing at their experiences. That, you know, so you're laughing at the non-disabled person's reaction to someone with dwarfism and their reaction back to them. That becomes the comedy element. So it's not laughing at, oh, look, the dwarf is small. You can still have it in other ways that dwarf does something silly because, you know, but not because of their dwarfism. But that they're either included in comedy in that funny way, in a good way, like anybody else would be, or they're just in more serious roles. So it diversifies from the comedy.
Well, growing up, where did you see role models that were actually good role models for you?
I didn't see any. I cannot remember any. Oh, hang on. There was one. When I was growing up, an international audience might not recognize this, but I watched this comedy show called Rapsy Nesbit. And it was about a working class Glaswegian family and their friends. And there was, you know, an average size family, and they had this one son who had dwarfism. And none of the comedy was ever towards his dwarfism. And it was the only time I ever saw someone like myself, because I'm also from a council estate. And I saw them not laughing at his dwarfism. I saw them not mocking his dwarfism, but mocking everything else that was Scottish, say. And that was the only time I never saw any of a dwarf that I could ever admire growing up, because I grew up watching you know, The Wizard of Oz or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Snow White. And there's nothing to be admired there. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, this comes up multiple times as well in the different chapters, and that is talking about, you know, many of the contributors are actively creating their own spaces within arts and media. So how does this idea of creating new representations contrast with the historical trend of people with dwarfism being depicted primarily by others? So I guess I'm thinking about self-representation and choosing how one represents the self versus, you know, it being decided by a director or a producer who have their own prejudices. Can you talk a little bit about some of the different artists or actors that you talk to about creating their own roles?
Yeah, so this is a very powerful thing because it's, like you say, it's challenging the, you know, this ableist representation of dwarfism that's existed for centuries and something that directors just carry on with or creators carry on with. So they create their own roles or they push for their own roles. So like Danny Woodburn, you know, he talks about how he had numerous conversations with various casting directors, writers, whatever, to say, well, actually, can you not do this? I don't need to be biting someone's backside. I'm a 40-year-old man. I don't need to be doing that. You know, so negotiating with producers and saying, well, can we do it in this way? Or, you know, he talks about how he was an extra on Murder, She Wrote, and then you know, just started speaking to the star, Angela Lansbury, and she brought him back because she realized this is the person that can have a, you know, an actual speaking role. And so it was constantly challenging him in that way. And then Nick Nowicki does the Easter Seals Disability Film Festival, which is not just people with dwarfism, but so many other disabled creators creating their own narrative, creating their own representation, which is really powerful because it's putting it, the representation, the creativity into our own hands instead of this disempowering non-disabled person's view of dwarfism.
Yeah, well, you know, something that I wanted to point out was in your epilogue, you touch on the diverse racial experiences of dwarfism. And then there's also the chapter about Midget Bardot, who it comes at it from a complicated gender and sexuality point of view. Can you discuss a little bit of the intersectionality of what it means to be a dwarf?
Yeah, I think because like growing up, I predominantly most representations of dwarfism are men. So it's always this thing that they're just races of men. And I think they touch on that in like Hobbit and stuff. So, so as a woman with dwarfism, there was absolutely nothing. And then, but Midget Bardot, who's Tam Reynolds, you know, they talk about being in these queer spaces and it's a lot more empowering to them. You know, because that's the thing, we have multiple identities. People seem to think that every dwarf is the same and they don't realize that you actually, you know, I'm a woman, I'm a, you know, this and that, I'm everything. Like, I have multiple identities, but you're reducing me to the dwarfism. Now, I can't speak on the race part because I am a white woman, and so I'm not going to speak on behalf of dwarfs from ethnic minorities. But what I did do is I did call out, you know, and wanted their sort of input, but didn't get really any response because I noticed there's not as many opportunities perhaps. But I think that would be interesting, you know, the intersections of different identities and stuff. But what I did find was whilst there's a lot of men who are proactive, like Woodburn and Minty and Vicky and all of them, it seems to always be predominantly women that are pushing this narrative for the, you know, the social acceptance and the better representations.
Can you talk a little bit more about that queer space? The idea of being subversive in that space has a different sort of audience, it seems.
Yeah. So Midget Bardot finds it much better to be in queer spaces, finds it much more accepting, much safer, because I think it's both Tam and Steph, there's probably others, that, and I, well, in my other research, certainly, that you don't feel welcome in disabled spaces because they don't see you as disabled. So, you know, I think Steph touched upon how she said to someone, yeah, they asked her what a disability was and she said dwarfism. And they said autism. And she went, no, dwarfism. Oh, I didn't realize that was a disability. So a lot do feel excluded from these disability circles. That's not to say that disability advocacy and everything isn't a great thing, but we are on the margins. So Tam in this queer space said, you know, they get treated like royalty because this is another minority group who's being treated just horrendously. And they see another minority group, so they come together and it's a lot more welcoming, they say, to be in that queer space. So sort of, you know, in drag performances. And it's a different audience. So you're not preaching to the converted as you are in some disability arts, but you're preaching to a different audience, raising different awareness about the wolfism.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One thing too that struck me was this idea of dwarf culture and what that looks like. I know that one of your contributors really wrote quite a bit about that. And I was just wondering, after your experience of working with these different authors and exploring this so deeply in your other writing as well, can you talk about dwarf culture and if that really is something that's possible to achieve?
I think it definitely could be. I think it'd be a great thing because it's our own culture then. I mean, it risks then saying that we are this separate race, and of course we're not. But we need to create our own sort of culture within disability culture and disability cultural representations. And it's just about saying, well, we're not having them created by non-disabled average-sized people because they tend to get it wrong, but creating our own representations. And I think Nick, of course, talks about that, Nick Novicki, and creating our own sort of representations in films and on TV, and sort of saying, well, this is just the roles we want to play. We're not going to be like that anymore. We're not just going to be seven elves or dwarfs. We are going to be, you know, just in everyday representations, creating our own platforms, our own spaces. Like, you know, Tam does it with drag. So you've got the intersection of wolfism and drag, and you've got, you know, Steph's art exhibitions and Deborah Keenahan's sculptures and stuff. This is what dwarf culture is. It's creating our own art in various ways.
Yeah, I see quite a bit of diversity in the dwarf community. And one thing that just again struck me, and I think I brought this up a little bit earlier, is about disability and how it's not viewed as a disability. But even within the dwarf community, there could be prejudices against somebody else for not being dwarf enough. Can you talk a little bit about variances in the dwarf community?
Yeah, so I think this is something Steph Robson touches on quite a lot. So the most common form of dwarfism is achondroplasia. And so not surprisingly, that's what most of our contributors to the book have. I myself have achondroplasia. And so it was a good insight what Steph Robson was telling me, because she doesn't have achondroplasia. And forgive me, I cannot remember off the top of my head, but I think it's Russell's Silver syndrome that she has, which, so she's very, you know, she's still very short, but she's perhaps doesn't look as like a stereotypical dwarf. So she was saying, you know, when she's gone to sort of associations with people with dwarfism and sort of met other people, they've sort of said, well, you're not a dwarf. And of course she is. She has dwarfism. But it's that exclusion then. So we have our own prejudices, you know, like just like any group does. And this prejudice is that you don't fit the proper dwarf representation. And I think others also touch on it who've had their legs lengthened, perhaps, you know, in the dwarf communities, they're very much against leg lengthening. For me, it's a personal choice. I've never had it done, but my parents always gave me the choice. And I think a lot of them feel excluded because they've had that procedure done, you know? So there's always those kind of things. And also, I think Alice Lambert speaks about it when she said she did panto once because all these dwarfs said, no, Alice, it's great, you know, because she went to the LPUK, you know, association, which is the patron is Warwick Davis, and he put her on the books without her knowing, she says. And so she was saying, like, you know, I did panto once, and when you speak out against panto, those dwarfs really turn on you because you are not allowed to speak out against it. And they're basically trying to silence you. And she talks about that one protester because who was worried about their kids being mocked as well as themselves. And so a lot, you know, will turn against you and get quite nasty if you are against this sort of midget entertainment.
Yeah, you mentioned that in your, well, you talk in detail about it, that in your epilogue. So can you maybe talk a little bit more about the complexities that this choice makes for people and why it continues to be a topic of debate within the dwarfism community?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's a choice. And whilst they say they have a choice to do it, it's our choice because of the backlash we get to speak out against it. Because, you know, if you've got one dwarf doing, say, dwarf tossing, but then it impacts 10 people negatively, just as a, you know, an example, then the ethics of that choice needs to be questioned. And we know that, you know, when throughout history, when dwarves have done like the seven dwarfs, being freak shows, whatever, we can't change that, but we can change the present day. And so if someone, like, there's a few dwarfs that hire themselves out, chained to a stag or, you know, hen when they're on the night out, that impacts us negatively. Now, if they say they have the right to do that because it's got a good financial incentive, then we have the right to speak out about it because it's impacting us. If it didn't impact us, none of us would say a thing. It's their choice. But it impacts the social standing and the safety of the rest of us. You know, we cannot go out without being mocked, you know? So I understand, and like Danny Woodburn and all that said, it's kind of their choice. What we should be fighting against are the people that really make money from this, like the managers, the event agencies, the producers, the directors, writers that make money from dwarf exploitation and stopping it there. And that if you're going to have someone with dwarfism, they can still be entertainers, providing they've got a talent. But it's like for anybody else, not everyone can become an actor.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. I mean, acting is just one small career that's extremely difficult and competitive. But we're talking about people wanting to be doctors and lawyers and have regular careers like everybody else.
That's what stops a lot of it. Like, you know, we all want these regular careers like doctors, teachers, and yet so many of us have faced discrimination against that because the views that the people hiring us have are that we are just funny novelties. And there's the one, the lawyer I talk about, Paul Stephen Miller, who graduated from Harvard and was told that, you know, he wasn't hired because people think that the law firm was running a circus. That's the kind of impact it has.
Well, how have you seen things change in the last 5, 10, 15 years? Has there been progress?
There's been some good progress. So, of course, everyone knows Peter Dinklage. Even if they haven't watched Game of Thrones, they know of it. I'd go back a bit further than that and go, there's been some other great ones like Danny Woodburn in the 90s, Linda Hunt in the 80s, and Meredith Eaton in the sort of noughties. Where these actors with dwarfism, like Kieran Estabell, of course, who are pushing that. Now, there's great, but for every one of them you have like quite a few other dwarfs still wanting to do midget wrestling and having someone like Shane McMahon defending it because he makes money from it, you know? So I don't think we have progressed greatly, but there are these little pockets of progression that we see. And that, I mean, you know, in this day and age, when you still get excited because you've seen that, like, someone like Kieran Estemmel's being cast as a doctor's receptionist in the British soap, medical soap Doctors, you're like, wow, a receptionist. And nobody else would ever look twice at that. But for someone with dwarfism, that demonstrates how little progress we've made, because these are not, you know, these are just everyday roles that anybody else takes for granted.
Well, what do you think the future holds for the representation of dwarfism in the arts? And how can associations better support individuals who are leading the charge for change?
I think, like, you know, there's been some good changes recently. Like, I get asked to consult on quite a few things that where people, production companies want to make something more, better representation or less offensive representation. And that's great. I think associations should be calling out derogatory representations, like, and explaining why. So if it's like being hired out for stag do's or midget wrestling, anything like that, and just promoting and calling for better representations, educating for that. So it's not doing anyone out of a job, but it's just saying, if you want this, then, you know, you at least have to have some talent beyond your dwarfism to do it. And they should always be calling it out and supporting those who are calling it out.
Well, are you being heard? You know, I mean, we just had this Disney movie that's about to come out. And instead of having real life dwarfs, they've made it digital, computer generated. Can you talk about how complex that issue is?
Yeah, I've got to be careful because I was a consultant, or I'm a consultant for Disney. And to me, I'm glad they're CGI because why do, you know, they're a mythical creature, not someone with dwarfism. So they're like elves, imps, you know, those kind of creatures. They're magical. They're not, you know, they're just to be sort of laughed at. So I think it all comes down to how the CGI sort of minors are represented and how they might represent dwarves in the film as a whole. And I think we just got to be careful. We've got to watch it first. But I think the worst thing is it, because they've used 7 CGI sort of characters. You had Peter Dinklage calling out, which was good. And then you had this one midget wrestler, Dylan Possel, who claims he can fight other wrestlers, which is, you know, the funniest thing I've ever heard a dwarf say. And it's like, he said, the heroes is to jump. Oh, hang on. From my research, most people are dwarfs and can't walk down the street without having hi-ho sung at them or being asked where their, you know, 6 little friends are. So this is why it was good for it to change. And, you know, hopefully the film has changed a lot to promote a more updated, you know, representation and not one based on the freak shows, like what Walt Disney did.
Well, it seems that, I mean, I think every chapter mentions Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. So obviously this has had a huge impact on the community and in representation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, probably the most famous representation of dwarfism because it is a fantastic film. I'm not going to deny that. I watched it when I was a kid because I liked watching most Disney films when I was a kid. It was certainly never my favorite, but I didn't have any problem with it. And I guess I wouldn't now. And I guess most people think dwarfism wouldn't if other people could tell the difference between fiction and reality. And so, you know, you get a lot of middle-aged men who seem to think that a film for 7-year-old girls is somehow real. And that's the problem.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. For more information about my guest and for a transcript of today's episode, please see our website. I'd like to thank my guest today, Aaron Pritchard, and the studio, This Is Distorted.